Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Wednesday, May 11th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Scott.
And I'm April Austin.
In high school, when I started dating the woman who would become my wife, I was immediately attracted by her hilarious off-color quips. And she totally got my wry jokes. Neither of us would make it on the stand-up comedy circuit, but a shared sense of humor, according to a new dating app, is key to a good relationship. The Smile app identifies your style of humor by showing video clips of, say, The Office, Friends, and The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. If you laugh, tap the heart. After creating a humor profile, using 8 styles ranging from sarcastic to self-deprecating, you're given possible dating matches. The app taps research done by Jeffrey A. Hall, a professor at the University of Kansas. Dr. Hall's findings say that humor underlies successful relationships because it confirms to your partner that you get them. Dr. Hall, an advisor to Smile, says, when people have a shared sense of humor, they reveal themselves as having a similar outlook on the world. Perhaps, just as importantly, it opens them up to playfulness. Dating apps, Dr. Hall suggests, are often based on the applicant's not quite accurate self-descriptions. But humor, he says, is hard to fake. A 2019 Pew Research study found that while 30% of U.S. adults have used a dating app or website, only 12% said they found a long-term relationship via online dating. The founder of Smile, Melissa Mullen, who has a background in physics and software development, says she has been an active and disappointed user of dating apps. Her epiphany came when she realized her most successful dates were with men who could make her laugh. She's been working on the Smile app for more than a year. The official launch is June 1st. Does laughter really lead to lasting love? We'll see. But I can confirm, after more than 40 years, my wife still makes me smile. Now, today's stories. Our first story. What motivates American veterans to make personal and financial sacrifices to help Ukrainians? Our reporter talks to U.S. veterans in Lviv, Ukraine, about the moral clarity and historical precedents that drive their choices.
The war in Ukraine has attracted U.S. military veterans and Western legionnaires like no foreign battlefield in recent memory. But what motivates mid-career professionals, often now married with children and with their former military lives receding into memory, to drop everything to assist another nation's fight? Some are impressed by Ukrainian pluck and resolve. Others see a historic battle between good and evil. It's also just a very clear conflict, with a democracy being invaded by essentially an authoritarian state and a land grab, says Matthew Van Dyke, a former documentary filmmaker whose nonprofit is helping train Ukrainians for the battlefield. It's a no-brainer as far as right and wrong in this. His group's military trainers have completed 1 2-week session for Ukraine's Territorial Defense Service and are now working with the National Guard in Kyiv. Jason, a former U.S. Army combat medic from Maryland who joined the group, says the Ukraine war burned in me from the start. I've seen shopkeepers, 17-year-old girls who are students, and farmers, people who have never held rifles in their lives. It's inspiring, he says. They're doing it with nothing. They're giving it their all. This story was reported by Scott Peterson in Lviv, Ukraine, for The Monitor.
The 1919 Treaty of Versailles and the Yalta Conference in 1945 offer 2 historic models as to what a post-war settlement might look like with Russia.
Sooner or later, it seems inevitable that the war in Ukraine will come to a negotiated end, whatever the military situation. But what kind of an end? two paradigms present themselves. The Treaty of Versailles, which ended World War I by imposing harsh terms on Germany that contributed to Adolf Hitler's rise, and the Yalta Conference in 1945, where Joseph Stalin, Franklin Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill charted the shape of Europe after World War II, paving the way for Moscow's domination of Eastern Europe. Washington and its NATO partners know they will have to reach a modus vivendi with Russia, whatever the war's outcome, which makes a Versailles-style humiliation unwise. But none of the Western allies, least of all Ukraine, will be in the mood to humor Vladimir Putin's nostalgia for the old Soviet Union's influence on the world stage. That suggests the nature of the West's dauntingly difficult challenge. Whenever the Ukraine war offers the chance for a negotiated peace, to trace a middle path between Versailles and Yalta. This column was written by Ned Temko in London for The Monitor.
The invasion of Ukraine dramatically shifted any trust in Russia, especially in Finland. Our reporter looks at how history and geography fed the near-universal change among Finns to join NATO.
Just as Russia's invasion of Ukraine has created a seismic shift in Europe's security environment, it has also shaken the psychology of its individual peoples. In Finland, that has meant the public's rapid abandonment of its longtime preference for officially staying outside NATO. Now, according to a recent poll, over 75% of Finns support applying for full membership, something that, by all reports, Finland is now on the threshold of doing. The Finnish people opened the door for the government to change, says Pekka Haavisto, the Finnish foreign minister. For years, joining NATO has been a minority position among the Finns. As recently as late 2021, only 22% of the populace favored giving up the country's non-aligned status and signing up. The idea of bolstering the nation's security has been an on-and-off topic for a long time, says Ilkka Rantaho, a freelance writer and musician. Finland's position in the world seems to be very stable, so no change was needed. Then February 2022 made it clear that our trust in Russia had always been misplaced, he says. Joining NATO seems the best way to continue the peaceful life we have been accustomed to. This story was reported by Gordon F. Sander in Helsinki for The Monitor.
In rural Georgia, our reporter explores why local Republicans champion environmental stewardship in opposing a new Rivian truck factory, while the GOP governor backs economic and racial equality.
Plans by the California-based Rivian electric vehicle truck maker to build a massive plant and battery assembly on a rolling old farm in Rutledge, Georgia, face unexpected pushback from a key bloc of rural Republicans. They're concerned about environmental and social impacts and the right balance between stewardship and progress. The problem with how we address climate change issues is that they affect the entire world, but the costs of addressing them have to be paid at the local level, says Emily Diamond, an environmental policy expert at the University of Rhode Island. They want to do it here because we don't have unions, they can get cheap labor, and they won't have trouble with permitting, says Edwin Snell, a longtime Rutledge resident who opposes the project. But for Phyllis Reed, a Black professional who commutes 2 hours to work in Atlanta, the racial and class aspects of resistance to the Rivian plant are unmistakable. A lot of it, she says, is a function of white property ownership going back before the Civil War. Bruce Altznauer, the mayor of Rutledge, sees a way for the plant to meet the needs of past and future, stewardship, and progress. My job is not just to protect the citizens who are celebrating the town's 150th anniversary this year, he says. I've got to make sure there's a 300th birthday. This story was reported by Patrick Johnson in Rutledge, Georgia, for The Monitor.
In this story about a St. Louis bakery, a criminal background doesn't define you. A reporter finds redemption and hope amid the measuring cups.
After 15 years in prison, Eric Satterfield had two options for work experience on his resume: jobs before prison or jobs in prison. When you come out of prison, you think everybody is thinking about why I went to prison, and that's not really true, says Mr. Satterfield. His prison time held no stigma for the nonprofit Laughing Bear Bakery, which only hires people with criminal records to help them get a solid footing in the workforce. A year at the bakery helped him transition into a full-time job at a manufacturing center. Being able to imagine a new self is key to successful reentry, explains Naomi Sugia, an associate professor of criminology, law, and society at the University of California, Irvine. And it requires spaces like the bakery where returning citizens are not always having to explain themselves in terms of their past mistakes, she says. Founder Kaylin McAllister hatched the Laughing Bear Bakery idea during a career as a prison chaplain, when she realized counseling inside prison walls was only a partial solution. Change was needed outside, too. When she retired, she explains, "On my way out the door, I said, I'm going to do something to solve this." This story was reported by Tara Adhikari in St. Louis for The Monitor.
Now, commentary from The Monitor's editorial board on Colombia's presidential election. If Gustavo Petro becomes president of Colombia in an election later this month or in a June runoff, as opinion polls suggest, his rise would be relevant far beyond his politics or within the region's geographic boundaries. His biography holds a lesson for societies on how to disarm insurgencies and terrorist movements through reconciliation and political accommodation. In his youth, Mr. Petro was active in Colombia's 19th of April movement, or M19, a faction that sought democratic change through guerrilla tactics in the 1970s and 1980s. The group morphed into a political party following the 1990 peace accord with the government. Several of its members went on to impactful political careers. Mr. Petro, a trained economist, served two terms as mayor of the capital, Bogotá. Colombia replicated its model in the 2016 agreement that ended a 52-year war with another guerrilla faction known by its Spanish acronym, FARC. The deal guaranteed political inclusion for disarmament. In one form or another, similar peacemaking dialogues are underway in communities along Pakistan's border with Afghanistan and in countries battling Islamist groups in Africa's Sahel region. That's our news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. For more Monitor audio, including our latest podcasts, go to csmonitor.com/podcasts. Thanks for joining us. Come back tomorrow. We'll have a review of a book by a philosopher recounting funny and profound conversations with his young sons about morals and the meaning of life. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how, after feeling overwhelmed by the logistics of teaching during the pandemic, alertness to inspiration from God brought strength, solutions, and joy. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Finally, a grace note of gratitude to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton, Tim Malone, and Tara Adhikari.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2022.